Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Christine Forster makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's a well-known national and Sydney figure, but speaking here for the first time. Christine Forster's background is in journalism, particularly in the oil and gas industry, and she currently works in corporate affairs. But she's here tonight because she was elected to council, the City of Sydney Council in 2012 and re-elected in 2016. And as a councillor, she has a lot of important things to say, so we thought we'd ask her here tonight to talk on the topic of Sydney, what is to be done. Christine, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, for that kind welcome. And thank you, of course... Thank you, of course, to Gerard and Anne for, in particular, for inviting me to the Sydney Institute to speak to you tonight about what is to be done in Sydney. In short, Sydney needs a change, but more about that later. It's indeed a great honour for a mere City of Sydney councillor to be invited to this venerable forum, walking as I do in the footsteps of prime ministers and premiers, opposition leaders and other great Australian intellectuals, patriots and entertainers. I should also acknowledge that I'm not the first member of my family to speak to the Institute, coming as I do in the wake of my much older brother, Tony Abbott, who is, in my quite biased, of course, opinion, all of those things. A great Australian politician, thinker, certainly a patriot, and even at times an entertainer. But as a politician who's focused on local rather than state or federal, what I'll be talking about tonight are the things that really impact people's day-to-day lives. And I'd like to stress that the reason I am in local politics is because I'm a Liberal. And I believe to my core that the central tenets of my party should be brought to bear every bit as much in the third level of government, just as crucially as they should be at state and federal level. In short, if you cut me, I bleed blue. But what does that mean? It means I believe in local government that is small and lets people get on with their lives to make the most of the opportunities they see for themselves. That incentivises its citizens and businesses to reach their maximum potential. That engages in genuine dialogue and doesn't dictate. That works to ensure that no member of our community is left behind and that does what it can to preserve our environment for our children and the generations that follow. Those are the things I believe in passionately and are the principles I've applied in everything I've done in the 7 years I've been privileged to represent my community as a City of Sydney councillor. But I've been fighting to uphold those principles from the opposition bench, which I can tell you is a challenge in an autocracy. For those of you who don't know, let me tell you a little bit about the City of Sydney Council. By the time the next local government elections come around in September 2020, it will be 40 years since Clover Moore was first elected to South Sydney Council. And she will have been Sydney's Lord Mayor for 16 years. And in all of that time, she has been in a position of absolute power, holding five or six seats in her own party, which always gives her a majority in the council of 10, thanks to the Mayor's casting vote. And although she claims to be an independent, Clover Moore rules the most disciplined party room, I would argue, Australia has ever seen. In 7 years, I could count on a couple of fingers the times those supposedly independent politicians haven't block voted Clover Moore's line. I certainly know more than one former Liberal parliamentary leader who would have welcomed the unflinching compliance the Lord Mayor enjoys from her party room. So, in the City of Sydney, the economic engine room of the country, Australia's only global city with a $120 billion economy accounting for 20% of New South Wales's economic output and 7% of GDP, This city of Sydney has had the same unchallenged chief executive for nearly two decades. There isn't an organisation in the world that would think that that's a healthy governance model. It's the realm of dynasties and dictators. As US businessman Alfred E. Perlman famously said, after you've done a thing the same way for 2 years, look it over carefully. After 5 years, look at it with suspicion. And after 10 years, throw it away and start all over. That's a maxim I'm sure would bring a wry smile to the face of John Howard or Margaret Thatcher if she was still with us. But by that measure, we are years overdue for renewal in the city of Sydney. What needs to be done is a modern approach, fresh commitment and energy, real change. And only a Liberal will bring that real change. As any one of you who have watched city politics since 2004 will know, the Lord Mayor is an ideological green. If she doesn't run herself next September, we know from experience she will anoint an apparatchik, committed to her doctrine and likely surrounded by her current advisers. Any other credible independent candidate will hail from the left, and the Labor candidate, well, will be the Labor candidate. If we are to have change to sensible, centre-right government in Sydney, and that is what needs to be done, the only choice is the Liberal Lord Mayoral candidate. As we all know and we can see as we walk the streets, Sydney is witnessing a once-in-a-generation process of renewal. The world-class Barangaroo development is transforming the western edge of the CBD. Sydney Metro will see a clutch of new stations built in the local government area. The fish market and football stadium are being replaced. Technology and innovation parks are planned for the Central and Everleigh precincts. A major build-to-rent project is on the drawing board for Redfern. Waterloo is to be developed with new social and affordable housing. The art gallery has been being expanded and a new cultural hub is under construction in Walsh Bay. These are projects that are worth tens of billions of dollars and they will deliver returns for Sydney and its people for decades into the future. And all this is happening because we have a strong, committed, smart and energetic state Liberal government. To get these projects done properly, Sydney now needs the same in Town Hall, or we risk not having these nation-building investments brought to fruition as effectively and economically as possible. Instead, for the past 15 years, Sydney has had a Lord Mayor who has specialised in the politics of division. She surrounded herself with a fortress of personal staff, 25 at the last count, costing $43.5 million to the ratepayers over the next decade. And she's ruled council with an iron fist that ignores the minority. She's whipped up conflict where it doesn't exist. She's stopped listening to anyone whose view doesn't match her own. But the Lord Mayor is no longer fighting the establishment. She is the establishment. Since I was elected in 2012, I've made it my business to consult with as many constituents as I can to ensure what I do every day in council and what I hope to offer again in September 2020 will make Sydney function at its very best so that living and doing business here is easy, it's enjoyable, it's safe and it's sustainable. Some of the things I've been able to instigate from opposition include the city's first smoke-free zone in Martin Place, now expanded to Pitt Street Mall, and George Street, 15 minutes free parking in high street shopping strips, the installation of synthetic sporting fields, planned feature lighting to brighten up Oxford Street, an audit of street parking signage across the city, a review of shared zones in Chippendale, and the potential use of new technology which cleans plastics and other litter from the harbour. I was also able to force the Lord Mayor's hand to remove the Occupy Sydney protest camp, which she had allowed to remain in Martin Place for several years. But in my time on council, I've also heard from entrepreneurs who tell me Melbourne is an easier place to work than Sydney, from tech startups who need council to assist with affordable office space, from digital technology specialists who say Sydney is not interested in new ideas, from environmental innovators who cannot persuade council to incentivise people to reduce their own carbon footprints. I've heard from small business owners who despair at the cost and red tape involved in doing simple things like securing outdoor dining approvals or putting up a sign. From big businesses who are worried about attracting and retaining staff and say Sydney isn't competing with other regional cities. From planning professionals who are frustrated by council's inefficiency and lack of transparency. I've heard from major tourism and events operators who need a strong advocate in Town Hall, from leaders in the arts sector who are looking for a fresh approach, and from not-for-profits who need a collaborative, outcome-driven response to solving the really tough social problems like homelessness. I've heard from residents who are watching precious parking space disappear from the streets where they live, who see dollars wasted on poorly planned local projects, unnecessarily ambitious public artworks and protest campaigns against the major infrastructure that Sydney really needs. And sadly, I've heard way too often from residents, local business chambers and community groups who simply cannot navigate council's inflexible, one-size-must-fit-all mentality when they have an issue that sits outside the box. All of that is what needs to change to get Sydney working at its best again, and the first thing that needs to be done is we need a local leader who listens, responds and delivers. Our city needs more than a self-serving spin machine that hears only its own dogma, that trumpets everything that's popular and takes no responsibility for anything that isn't. To quote another American businessman, Arnold H. Glasso, a good leader takes a little more than his share of blame, a little less than his share of the credit. Well, Councillor Moore would do well to heed that advice. Sydney needs a Lord Mayor who understands that businessmen and women are not the enemy. They are important members of our community and who, instead of railing against them being required to vote, knows that they should have a say. We need a leader that knows Council's bank account and capacities to support future community services and infrastructure depends on the success of our business sector. Sydney needs a Lord Mayor who not only values the unique character of our villages, but provides each community with the opportunity to shape and implement projects that will make a real difference to them. Who accepts that Greater Sydney is going to grow from 5 million to 8 million people in the next few decades and will help plan for that, rather than resist what needs to happen to accommodate those new residents. A Lord Mayor for whom sustainability means the triple bottom line and whose policies for protecting our environment are focused more on achievable, cost-effective solutions and less on pleasing the international environmental elite. We need a Lord Mayor who can move with the times, embrace modern technology and ideas, and who welcomes change and renewal. A leader who knows you can achieve more for your constituents when you have a place at the negotiating table with the other levels of government, and who embraces Sydney's unique and nationally important responsibility to the people of the metropolitan area, the state and the nation. Change is what needs to happen. I was privileged to be the Liberal Lord Mayoral candidate in 2016. And as part of my campaign then, I promised to implement a reform that would have turned the way Sydney Council operates on its head. I pledged that I would give each of the 10 councillors elected, no matter what party they represented, a specific portfolio of responsibility, one that reflected their expertise and interests and allowed them to drive the change they each wanted to see in our city. The portfolios I proposed then were economic development, infrastructure, technology, community, environment, transport, tourism, events, planning and the arts. I still want to see that done. Not only because it would mean the end of the divisive politicking peddled by the Lord Mayor, but because it would make all 10 councillors who are important to the global city responsible and accountable. In 2016, I also promised to establish regular listening posts at our village markets, where people who aren't handpicked devotees would be able to speak directly with council staff. And I committed to personally tracking how council responds to that feedback. Again, that still needs to be done. In 2017, I moved a motion seeking to have the Lord Mayor and other councillors take questions without notice from the public. If you will, a local government version of estimates. Naturally, that was a transparency measure that was rejected out of hand by a Lord Mayor who prefers to operate behind a veil of secrecy, but it still needs to be done. What else? We have to have a council that genuinely embraces the modern data science and innovation that can so easily and cheaply improve our residents' quality of life, our businesses' productivity, and our council's transparency. I asked council to develop a city dashboard in 2015, and we still have nothing. Lagging by years other global cities like London, Los Angeles and Singapore. To put that in context, it's only been in the last few years that Sydney could offer ratepayers a way to pay their bills online, And we still haven't managed to install public Wi-Fi in the CBD, something that's been achieved by Woollahra, Penrith, Campbelltown, and even Leeton Shire Council, to name but a few. But how can we pretend to be ready for a future as the smart city our residents, businesses and visitors want and need if we can't even manage that? Sydney needs to get back to the basics. I've been asking Council for 4 years to take real action on Sydney's rat problem. Now, that's an environmental issue that should have been tackled before we declared a climate emergency. In 2017, I asked for the installation of solar-powered rubbish recycling bins, similar to those used in Melbourne and even in tiny provincial towns in New Zealand. Nothing's been done on that, but in the meantime, the Lord Mayor has jetted off to talk to the glitterati at the C40 Climate Change Summit. Council will spend $11.6 million over the next 3 years on staff whose sole responsibility is to look after the Lord Mayor. That is nearly twice the $6.6 million it has earmarked to look after the people of the city who are suffering homelessness. More than twice. Over the past few years, Clover Moore has spent around $1 million on a protest campaign against WestConnex, which will go ahead whatever she says or does, and her pet public art projects, which will never go ahead. To put that in context, that's 10 times what Council has committed to a state government-led initiative which is targeting a 50% reduction in the numbers of people sleeping rough on city streets. I repeat, 10 times more on politicking and failed art projects than has been invested in a multi-agency program to tackle rough sleeping. That needs to change. Since I've been on Council, we have never met our annual forecast spending on capital projects, and that's despite having a current cash balance of $684 million and a budgeted surplus for this year of $113 million. Take our biggest project as an example, the new Gunyama Pool and Park in Green Square. In 2014, that was forecast to cost $60 million and it was expected to be finished a few months ago. Now it's going to cost $103 million and stage one won't be completed until next year. That's the current forecast. Let's get back to the basics. Like, for instance, cutting through the massive red tape that's costing our business community time and money. Over the past few years, Sydney has at times run more than 2 weeks behind its own targets on processing development applications. That should have been addressed before the Lord Mayor turned her energies against a $500 million hotel investment in Pyrmont that would have created thousands of construction and permanent jobs. In short, there's an awful lot that needs to be done in Sydney. But the election is coming, and the Lord Mayor's ratepayer-funded publicity machine is already ramping up. Suddenly, after 15 years of inaction, Council says it wants to see a measurable reduction in rough sleeping. Suddenly, councillors are being told there is a roadmap to make Sydney smarter, despite the fact that our so-called digital city webpage hasn't been updated since August 2017. The production of promotional brochures is accelerating. The contrived consultations are in full swing. The aspirational targets that will never be met are being trotted out. So for me, the next 10 months or so will be a busy time. But that's great, because I'm passionate about my city, my home, and making sure it is the very, very best possible place to live, work, and work for my children and their children and their children. But with that election looming, I'd like to leave you with a message from the great Sir Robert Menzies, whose prescient words are remarkably relevant even when read three quarters of a century after they were spoken. Menzies said in a radio address ahead of the 1946 federal election, "As sensible people, we are bound to make a choice. It is ridiculous to vote for some member or candidate simply because we like him or respect him. For if he's elected, his real significance will be derived from the kind of government he supports, the policies he advocates, the kind of laws he helps to make. That is the choice the electors of Sydney will face in September 20, and that is why it's time for a Liberal Lord Mayor." Thank you very much.
You've got me tonight, sorry about that. That was great, Christine. We've got a lot of time, so you can all ask a question. Everyone ask a question. as Gerard usually does, fire off with the, I get the first question. I just think, looking at Sydney, and I've only been here for about 40 years.
Newcomer.
I'm a newcomer from Melbourne. And I look down at Melbourne and I think Sydney's great. But how much is this dependent on your electorate, where you've got a very big business community that sort of gets one vote here and there, and you've got all these inner city greenies who see Clover as their lefty hero? Can you tell us a bit about how that works and how it ever would change?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that question, Anne. It really is the burning question. You've hit the nail on the head. The breakdown of the electorate is around, last election was around 70,000 electors, residential electors, and there were a bit shy of 23,000 business electors enrolled. That was in the wake of the state government changing the rules to require businesses in the city of Sydney to be enrolled and to vote, just like citizens, and giving them, in fact, two votes if they had non-residential directors in the company. So despite that change of law, unfortunately from my perspective and I think for the democratic process, the state government left the putting together of the register in the hands of the CEO of Council rather than the Electoral Commission. So it's been a fraught process. I know, in fact, speaking to Gerard on the way in, he said that he hadn't been able to vote in the last two City of Sydney elections, despite having been a long-term tenant in the centre of the CBD, simply because the paperwork hadn't been filled in properly at one end or the other, and he hadn't been informed. And that happened time and time again last election, the 2016 election. So many people came up to me and said, I've just gone in, I'm a business elector, I've just gone in, I've been told I'm not on the roll. But even so, the electorate, as you rightly said, Anne, is a very green electorate. It's never been a Liberal electorate. This is what I and the rest of the Liberal team will be really working to achieve, and we have always been working to achieve, but of course we'll be working even harder to achieve in the run-up to the next election. And, you know, it is a very important election. As I've said, we do need change. We need change for the better in Sydney.
Okay. Now, over here now. I need a microphone. Just let me go and get a microphone.
Thanks, Christine, for your words and very broad-ranging number of topics that you've covered. There's one particular one I'd just like a comment on, if you could, please, and that's on the homeless problem. What's your vision for what you would do for the homeless problem that exists in Sydney? What agencies would you involve? What costs would you see involved with that? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, well, of course, it's a huge problem. And there is now a joint state government-led initiative which Council has signed up but only given $100,000 to, compared with the massive amount of money the Lord Mayor is prepared to spend on any number of wasteful projects like the failed cloud arch in George Street, which she wanted to spend $12 million on and counting, but luckily was ultimately held accountable. It is a terribly difficult problem, of course. It's a very complex problem. But this joint state government-led initiative, which does have measurable targets, the target is to reduce rough sleeping across the state, actually, not just in Sydney, but, of course, it's most visible here in Sydney, by 25% by 2020 and by 50% by 2025. And they are that's the first time I think there's been a target to actually say this is what we're going to do. It's a very broad coalition of state government, City of Sydney Council, Vinnies, a huge number of participants in that joint program. The state government, you know, as I said, is leading it. We will participate in it, but that's a small drop in the ocean, that $100,000 that we're doing. What we could be doing, actually, is putting more people on the streets, more council outreach staff on the streets to ensure that if somebody's, I mean, around Town Hall, there are people sleeping in doorways there every morning that you go. You know, our council outreach staff can be going out, checking in with them, supporting them into the services they need, you know, asking why are you here, how can we help you? Physically walking the streets and engaging with those people to try and ensure that they are getting into the safety nets that we have for them, because we do have wonderful safety nets in Australia. And I'm sure that you're like me and you walk around and you think it's terrible. It's a terrible thing that we have people begging on the corners of the CBD and sleeping in doorways when we have such sound safety nets that they could be accessing in this country, and they should be. So councils should be putting resources directly into engaging with those people.
Thank you. Paige, over here. Welcome to the first of your 100 appearances at the Sydney Institute.
Thank you. I'm too old for that.
It's a crossover area, but I'm sort of interested in the light rail project and the transports. I suppose the council has some input, but what I found very difficult was when the George Street was closed off, the buses went everywhere. Some terminate down the Domain, some go over near the Harbour Bridge. What's the idea when the trams are eventually running? Will George Street be only for the trams?
That's the section between Hunter and Bathurst Street. That's the plan. You've still got taxis income exiting out of the Hilton Hotel, for instance. But it's pedestrianised from Hunter to Bathurst. That was a compromise. The Lord Mayor initially... The light rail was born from the Lord Mayor's vision that she bought hook, line and sinker from Jan Gill, the Danish architect who came to visit, and the Lord Mayor thought was the Messiah, so to speak, in terms of urban planning and what she should be doing in the city of Sydney. And one of his things is light rail and pedestrianisation. I opposed the project initially, but the state government, in its wisdom, went ahead and signed a contract. And, of course, we're not like Daniel Andrews. We don't rip up contracts when we've signed them. So, you have to get behind the project when it's committed to. But I think eventually Sydneysiders will love it and will find it a great mode of transport. And it's designed to take buses off the roads, and it will serve very well as that. I hope that the state government resists the Lord Mayor's ongoing push to pedestrianise the entirety of George Street from Central to Circular Quay, which is what she would like to see happen. I think that would... this is the main north-south spine, transport spine of the city. I think that would be a poor decision. I think it needs to be open to keep the city moving. And to ensure that we don't get too congested. It was very interesting, though, that when they... In the couple of weeks before they started building light rail, the buses were rerouted. I don't know whether you remember that. Amid much fanfare about rerouting the buses, stop's not going to be where it normally is, and suddenly all the traffic congestion disappeared. So it could have been that maybe we just need to reroute the buses without spending $2.2 billion on an at-grade light rail, particularly when we're now spending tens of billions of dollars on Metro, and Metro would have been a better option. But it's done now. Let's love it.
We have another question? Yes, down there, Paige.
I'm not a resident of Sydney. I'm a resident of North Sydney, and so
we like North Sydney too.
Well, we sort of tolerate Sydney.
It looks good from this side of the bridge, anyway.
we have a nice view, and so the issues are obviously somewhat different in some respects. But in general, there are some issues I suspect carry over, at least in terms of the residential areas of Sydney. And one of the issues that I think a lot of people in North Sydney are particularly concerned about is Airbnb.
Yep.
And to put it bluntly, the state government has brought in regulations which sound great and are totally useless. And I wondered whether the city of Sydney, as representing those who live in large apartment blocks, had a view as to the ability of the residents of those blocks to determine for themselves, by proper majority, whether or not that phenomenon should persist, because the present state legislation, which is now coming in, will not serve the purpose.
Yeah, well, it's a vexed issue, I have to say. As a Liberal, I'm all in favour of people being entitled to do what they want with the property that they own. But, of course, it is a very vexed issue in strata property. The state government has said that they will restrict it to 90 days a year in strata, and I guess it's up to them to regulate that and make sure that the law is complied with. My own view was that if you're going to have Airbnb in strata, you should put the onus back on Airbnb. Airbnb and, you know, these point-to-point businesses operate on the provider and the user of the service rating each other, and that's how they remain successful. So my plan was, and I put this to the state government, was, well, why don't you allow the body corporate to rate the service provider as well? Because if somebody's letting a flat in a strata building and people are coming in and trashing the common areas or something like that because they're not residents, they're just visitors, if the body corporate can give them the owner of that flat through Airbnb a black mark, it only has to happen 3 times and they can't let their flat out at all. So that was my plan. Unfortunately, that fell on deaf ears. but it's up to the state government now to regulate what the conditions they've put in place. But it is a vexed issue. And I think that if corporate strata bodies get together and they, you know, strongly vote against something happening, then, I mean, that's democracy, but you've got to enforce it amongst yourselves, I suppose. The government's rules are the government's rules.
Thanks, Christine. Homelessness is clearly an issue. Another issue in the city of Sydney, in a related vein, is the overcrowding of apartments, often by young students in the vicinity of universities. Two-bedroom apartments in which you find, you know, 10 and 12 adults living, yeah, at slumlord rates. I presume it is against the law or regulation.
Of course it is.
But it seems not to be enforced. I wonder what the council can do about that and what your vision for clearing up that problem might be.
Well, again, you have to have a will to do something, to want to do something about it. And you can do if you have a will to change, to make change, you can take steps towards doing it, but you have to have that will first. It is a very difficult problem. Often these are apartments that, you know, they're big apartment buildings, lots of people come and go. The next door neighbours might be aware that there's, you know, that there's too many people in the flat next door, but maybe the building manager doesn't know because there are so many people coming and going. Council needs to put itself about a bit more, really. Again, put some more. We are a rich council. As I said, we've got $684 million in the bank right now. Very few governments in Australia can say that they're that financially sound. State government can, of course, but we can put resources into the problems where we need to put resources. We have that capacity, and there just needs to be a will to tackle it.
Thanks, Anne. First, a very minor comment, I guess, on the over-regulation question, that having rates or costs attached to the number of tables that you have out at night has a deterrent effect, e.g. the patrons opposite the Gymnasium Theatre can't have coffee outside because it costs the proprietors too much, blah, blah. I just mentioned that as a small example, but my question is, follows on about homelessness. I recall as a young doctor at Sydney Hospital, we used to go to Matthew Talbot Hospital and see people there, etc. But you mentioned safety nets. Could you elaborate on that a bit? I mean, if for instance in Martin Place there are many people sleeping and then they're moved, what is the safety net?
Well, the safety net, Robin, was the state government provided housing for them.
Right.
They were going down every single... When that politically motivated activist camp, which was whipped up by a political activist, I'm not for a second suggesting that there weren't people in dire need who were living there, but it was set up by a political activist. because he wanted to make a statement and a protest. He was the same man that was behind Occupy Sydney, that set up the tent city that then sprang up more recently in Martin Place. And the safety nets were there. The state government, when it sprang up, after a period, not as quickly as I would have liked to have seen them do it, started going down every single morning, sending teams of people down saying, we can house you. You know, we have the services. We have the agencies that you need to help yourself get back on your feet. And as a result, it's no longer there.
And does that apply to more generally to homeless people?
Yes, of course. Yeah, it just needs... council should be sending people out to speak to every morning. If there's somebody sleeping on the streets of the CBD, they should have the outreach to help them to get into the services they need, because the services are there. They really are. And that Martin Place example was a really stark illustration of the fact that the services are there. But that's not to say, I'm not detracting. It is a very, very difficult problem, and it's a complex problem. And most people, I think, or a lot of people who unfortunately find themselves sleeping rough, have all sorts of complex other issues that they need to be assisted with. But you know, we have a terrific health system, a terrific government housing system, terrific mental health capacity in this. Terrific drug and alcohol service assistance services. You know, they just need to be making. Council just needs to be playing its part to make sure that the people in need are being reached by the people that can give them the services they need.
Do you want to answer that one?
Yes, I just. It's a different debate in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Homelessness. Why do you think that is? It's quite interesting to compare and contrast.
Well, I don't. In all honesty, I'm not sure how they approach it in Melbourne. But one slight difference, and I don't know whether this makes a difference to their approach. But it's, for instance, it's not illegal to beg on the streets in New South Wales. As I understand it, it's illegal everywhere else in Australia, and so perhaps that means they take a different approach to people sleeping on the streets.
It's much more public concern.
Well, I would not suggest for a second that the people of Melbourne have bigger hearts than the people of Sydney. I think that, you know, there is deep concern in Sydney about the fact that we have rough sleepers and people, you know, who are having to sit on street corners and beg. I mean, I'm deeply concerned about that. That's why I want council to be taking steps and doing something about it, not just giving us platitudes. You know, that's what has to happen. That's what needs to be done.
Question over here.
Christine, hi. $684 million surplus. It strikes me to be a fairly wealthy council, and yet we never hear anyone talking about whether there could be some rate relief for ratepayers in the city. And at a point where the national discussion is around economic, you know, stimulus and the like, is there any thought from the Liberal Party or from yourself about whether rates are currently set at the appropriate level?
Well, thank you for reminding me that, in fact, the central tenet of our 2012 campaign, the Liberal team's 2012 campaign, when I wasn't the Lord Mayoral candidate, I was number two on the ticket, was a 10% rates cut across the board. Because purely for that reason, the council is rich. At that stage, at that point in 2012, I think it was the only government in Australia that had a cash surplus, that had money in the bank and zero debt. Only government in. So we, of course, give the ratepayers some relief. Absolutely. I mean, the city of Sydney could easily afford, but every time I've ever suggested how about some rates relief, that's fallen on deaf ears, of course. And the Lord Mayor complains about IPART limiting the rate increases to CPI. That's why we need a change.
In terms of the next 10 to 20 years, what do you see to be the future of private car in the city of Sydney?
depending on whether or not we have a change of government, look, clearly the direction that the city has been going for the last 16 years under Clover Moore, and a little bit before that when in the 1980s new apartment blocks were restricted in terms of how many parking spots, the owners of new apartment blocks were restricted in terms of how many street parking permits they could get. They could get none. And council has progressively applied rules that restrict the number of parking spaces that can be built into properties. So that's what's been happening in the sort of residential belt. The reason why the Lord Mayor wanted to pedestrianise George Street is to get cars out of the city. She would rather have apply a tax. I'm sure she would like to apply a user tax, a London-style tax, to dissuade cars from coming into the city. I think what's really going to dissuade people from bringing cars into the city is the tens of billions of dollars of metro infrastructure that the state government is building. And that will discourage cars, privately owned cars, from coming into the CBD. But we're always going to have vehicle movements. You know, this is a big, bustling, busy CBD. You know, people expect to be able to walk out in Hunter Street and get a cup of coffee. They expect to be able to fill their printer with paper if they need to. You know, you need to have vehicles coming into the city to provide the deliveries and the services that people need and want and expect. But that should be managed so that, you know, vehicle deliveries are managed so that they're coming in at off-peak times. You know, everybody needs a reduction in congestion. There's no doubt about that. It costs us billions of dollars a year. So it's a good thing, and hopefully we'll get smarter about it as time goes on and as the state, this good Liberal state government continues to invest in public transport infrastructure, which it's doing.
There's one down the back there, and then one in front. Push it up.
I think it's dead.
Okay.
Excuse me. He's not very far away. I can probably hear him.
Yeah. Christine, thanks for your talk. Clover Moore, I work in the city. I'm also a resident in Sydney City Council and have been for almost three decades. She's got a pretty neat vision, this 2030 vision. Whether you like it or not, it gives everybody something to focus on. How would you, and riding a bike is part of that strategy. How would you improve on that encouragement of bikes, walking?
I would continue to encourage it. It's part of reducing congestion that we've talked about. I mean, I live in Surry Hills, on Bourke Street in Surry Hills. Now that my children are no longer at school, I don't need a car. I can walk to work at Town Hall. I could ride a bike if I chose to, but I prefer to walk. There's certainly great cycling infrastructure already there that would enable me to safely ride a bike to Town Hall if I chose to. I would do everything to encourage modal shift to active transport because it's good for everybody. It's good for people's physical well-being, it's good for the environment, and it's great for reducing congestion.
Christine, my name is Carrington Brigham, you know who I am.
I'm
the Potts Point Partnership Business Chamber President. A question for you: we recently dealt with some City of Sydney officials in terms of having university students from USW come and tell us how they would like to see King's Cross revitalised.
Oh.
I had the privilege of assessing the ideas that they presented.
Hackathon.
Us. Yeah, it was fantastic. It was part of AGSN. It was fantastic. The City of Sydney official, when I turned and said to them, we would love to see some of that incredible amounts of money that's in your bank accounts to be spent to help revitalise the precinct, they bought the idea and turned around and verbatim said to us, we need that money in case a tidal wave hits Sydney. So how do you deal if you become the next...
Seriously?
Yes. So we all gasped and we all looked at each other in shock. But this was in a city.
Luckily, you're high up in Potts Point.
Exactly. We all looked at this City of Sydney official with a look of being dumbfounded on our faces. But I wanted to know from you, how would you, if you become successful as a Lord Mayor next year, how would you go about changing the culture of the City of Sydney staff?
Well, it's a great question, Carrington, and it is a big bureaucracy. There's 2,000 staff, roughly, in the City of Sydney, and you would have to change that culture. And, you know, if I were the Lord Mayor, I would start by reducing the numbers in my own office, to be honest, because 25 staff for the Lord Mayor of Sydney, Scott Morrison has 45, I think. Certainly when Barry O'Farrell was the Premier, she had several more than Barry O'Farrell. I think the Premier's office has slightly ballooned a little bit since then. But, you do have to change the culture, and the culture has to come from the top. So, in all honesty, you would have to change the staff at the top so that they were people who thought along the same liberal lines that I think. That's just the reality of how you go about the process of change in big organisations.
Despite appearances, I was born last century, but what I love is when you see the building sites and you've got all the old photos of Sydney in various stages, and that is that intended to happen to every building site or, you know, various locations around the City of Sydney?
How do you mean?
They've got photos of all the Sydney intersections. And, you know, things like that. So that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it is, and actually that is a council policy, the hoardings policy, that people are required to put those historic photos on, and I 100% agree with you. I think that is a great thing. They are really interesting. They make a hoarding not a hoarding, a piece of artwork, and they are fascinating photos. And I mean, we often stop and look at them, particularly when they're around your own local neighbourhood, because you see stuff that, you know, obviously hasn't been there for years and years, and it's a great thing. So a big tick to council for that. Credit where credit's due. Yeah.
Hi, Christine. Actually, just following on from Carrington's question, I'm keen for your vision for the King's Cross precinct, especially now that it looks like the lockout laws are being relaxed somewhat.
Yeah, that's big fingers crossed on that. The joint standing committee on the nighttime economy was an interesting experience. I made a submission to the committee. I spoke in person to the committee. It was a multi-party committee across Liberal, Nationals, Greens, Labor, Shooters and Fishers, Independents. It was a very good committee, and they were all looking for cover to roll back the lockout laws, in my view, which was very positive from my perspective, because the impact they've had on the city's nighttime economy has been far beyond what was anticipated. Sure, at the time we needed a circuit breaker. We had a real problem in King's Cross. We didn't, you know, it was a problem that was spiralling out of control. You had, 20,000-30,000 young people going up to the cross of a weekend pre-fueled, from coming in from outside of the city pre-fueled to, cause trouble. And we did need a circuit breaker. I would make the point, though, that most of the terrible trouble that happened, and that was those two deaths in the lead-up to the lockouts being imposed in 2014, that all happened early on in the evening, and it was perpetrated by young men who were pre-fueled before they came to King's Cross. But we certainly needed a circuit breaker. It had the desired effect. I mean, the culture of the cross changed overnight when the lockout laws were imposed. Since then, there's been, I mean, Carrington will be able to tell you, there's been tens of dozens of venues close. Venues have changed purpose from, being a pub to a restaurant, but because they were on the at-risk list, you've still got to scan an ID to get into it after 9:30, 9 o'clock.
Yeah,
9 o'clock. That just has a terrible impact on a precinct, which, and in my view, was a very valuable cultural asset. You know, it had been there for decades. It was the red light district of a global city. Show me a truly global city that doesn't have a red light district. It was a great place. But anyway, the vision is, I mean, it's changed. and it'll never be what it was. And we have to manage that to make it the best. I mean, it's still a terrific place to live. The residents would probably say it's a better place to live now, but it doesn't have quite the character and the vibrancy that it used to. So we have to manage that, and that would involve making sure there's good mixed use redevelopment. Along the strip particularly. I mean, if you go up there now, I was up there yesterday, and there's so many empty shop fronts along the strip, it's just depressing, absolutely. So that needs to be, a council needs to oversee good, sensible mixed-use redevelopment. It'd be great if some of those state significant sites, for instance, like the one over the station where the hotel is at the moment, if that got redeveloped in a modern way to improve the connectivity through the precinct, because that's what really makes precincts work, is good connections with the areas around them, and council needs to come on board for managing that, and to turn around and say, well, we're going to, you know, give the local business chamber a slap across the face because we might have a tidal wave coming into the harbour. I mean, you know, what does that show about this council's approach to its business community? It says it all.
There's a question over there.
Its business community might add that contributes 75% of its rates revenue.
That's right, they get no
bucks. I understand that a global city and a capital city is going to have events in it which go beyond its own immediate constituency and its own geography.
I hope so.
However, as people who worship in a church in the city, it seems that every second Sunday the roads are closed and we can have outside our door while we're trying. I mean, we like to think the church has a presence throughout the week, but nevertheless, an important part of our core business is on a Sunday morning. And so often our core business is disrupted by very loud noises from outside, from a variety of things. It might be bike rides, it might be walks, it might be bands, it might be protests, all sorts of things. And it seems to me that we're a bit disenfranchised in that the good of the wider community is the altar on which our attempt to build community as important residents of the city or important constituents of the city is sacrificed.
Yeah, well, you make a good point. And in response, I would say that, you know, living anywhere successfully is all about getting the balance right between all the competing elements, all the competing users, all the different groups that want to be living or working or visiting a place, and getting the balance right is what we need to do. I mean, I don't regard the Lord Mayor ignoring a terrible rat problem for 4 years, and yet encouraging school students to come out on climate strike is getting the balance right. It's about, as I said, getting back to basics, and, you know, and ultimately it's about making sure that you do that because to make the amenity of the city better for everyone.
I have to say, the city of Sydney not having a red light district is rather disappointing.
It's terrible. I mean, it's a cultural, it's a heritage loss. It's a heritage loss.
Even Adelaide, I think.
Even Adelaide.
The city of churches had a red light.
Must be a small one, I would think,
though. Picking up on your comment about the Star Casino and the proposed development there, what is your view or vision for planning in areas such as Pyrmont, which is where I live, and mixing that sort of development with high-density living? Two questions, that's one. Second one is, given the outlook for population growth and high levels of consumption of water, what can and should the city or the council do to conserve water or encourage people to do more about conservation of water?
On that second point, I think council is strong on its water conservation and recycling approach to its own projects. In fact, just at our last council meeting, the Lord Mayor tabled a minute to, well, it was a bit of grandstanding, really, but as part of the light rail, there's been a water recycling pipe laid in George Street. It's not as connected as it could be, and the Lord Mayor wants now regulation change that would encourage dual dual pumping into new buildings from that pipeline and connecting the network. That's all very laudable, and I supported that wholeheartedly. I think that's a big thing that we can do. Certainly, as citizens, we can do what we can to limit our water use, and I think we all do that. I get yelled at if I leave the shower on for 10 seconds too long in the morning at home, so we're very conscious of it in our terrace house in Surry Hills, how tough it is for people out in the regions. But in terms of Pyrmont, and obviously the Star, the Ritz-Carlton Tower, the hotel tower, which the Lord Mayor insists on calling a casino, what has been controversial. I shouldn't preempt anything that the Planning Commission might say about it. I think there's a decision looming middle of the month. It's my view that that the Ritz-Carlton was a good development. Okay, it was big, it was tall, but you know, a global city needs tall and iconic buildings. And you know, if we had taken the attitude that the Lord Mayor takes, we wouldn't have Australia Square. We certainly wouldn't have Barangaroo. And look at what that is doing to transform our city. So again, it's about balance. It's about, you know, taking a pragmatic approach, being fair, and not just resisting change for the sake of it, because we need to grow, we need to develop, we need to change as a city. I mean, Sydney is going to have 3 million more people living here in the next 2 decades, and we need to be flexible about how we plan for that.
One down back.
I just wanted to know, are there other cities in the world that you look to that offer inspiring ways of solving some of the issues that face us here, you know, particular cities that you admire or are inspired by?
Yeah, look, you're not a local councillor, I don't expect, but I do it everywhere I go. Wherever I travel, I look at the good things that other cities are doing. I was in Barcelona, Virginia and I were in Barcelona a couple of weeks ago, and they've got recycling bins on every corner in Barcelona, yet we can't manage to do that in Sydney. And now I've tried to do that. I asked her to put solar-powered recycling bins into Sydney, and it was all too hard. Now, you know, the world has moved on in the last 10 years, I believe, firmly. I think your average citizen who walks the streets is very prepared to be responsible about putting recyclables in one part of the bin and rubbish that needs to go to landfill unavoidably goes to landfill in the other side of the bin. I don't think Sydney siders are that thick that they can't work that out, and we should give them the opportunity to do it by putting recycling bins on the street like they do in places like European cities like Barcelona. And I always look around Melbourne whenever I go to Melbourne. I have a very critical eye, and I have to say there are lots of things that they do very well. One thing they do is great signage on their cycling paths. In fact, which is not... I mean, I live on Bourke Street right next to the cycle path on Bourke Street, and the signage is about it being a cycle path is terrible, whereas in Melbourne, it's always really clearly marked, which is a great thing. And yeah, I always look for things, but there are so many great cities around the world, and I'm very lucky to be able to travel a lot. But at the end of the day, this is the greatest city in the world, and we can do what we can do here with our own expertise, our own ideas, our own skills, and our own energy and commitment to make it even better.
I just want to ask you one last little question. We wish you well in
Thank
the
you.
Campaign.
Thank you very much.
But if you weren't called a Liberal city councillor, would you have a better chance? And if you are going to call yourself a Liberal and have a team, can you get some big hitters behind you as well?
Well, there are plenty of big hitters behind us already.
But maybe state government and some other people. Is there a chance to kind of... Because it seems to me that your problem is that the state government is doing too much for the city of Sydney, and Clover is kind of riding that wave.
She does do that where it suits her. She's prepared to, you know, trot out for the photo opportunity with state ministers when she thinks it looks good for her. That's that reflected glory that she likes to put into her brochures, which come under the door, or are coming under the door now with increasing frequency as we get closer to the election. Look, the state government is fully supportive. The Premier and her team are fully and wholly supportive of the Liberal team's efforts in the City of Sydney, and will be wholly and fully supportive as we get closer to the election. I mean, the reality is this state government is doing an amazing job at delivering what it said it would deliver, and that can only be better if you have somebody who's genuinely going to cooperate with that state government in realising some of these massive investments and some of these ambitious plans, like, for instance, the rough sleeping target. A good liberal team with power in town hall can only improve the outcomes for everybody.
Okay, thanks, Christine.
We had an amazing discussion there. We went from red light districts to rats to homelessness to metros to skyscrapers in a global city. Christine, wonderful talk tonight, and I think the audience got a hell of a lot out of it. So thanks for coming, and we'll have you back for sure.
Thank you.
Probably as maybe a mayor? Anyway, thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.